From the Blue Ridge Mountains to the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia is a mecca for outdoor travel and adventure. Virginia Outdoor Adventures Podcast is the ultimate guide for local outdoor recreation, including hiking, camping, kayaking, and so much more. Get the information and the inspiration to plan your own adventure right here in Virginia. I'm your host, Jessica Bowser. How afraid should you be of ticks and tick-borne diseases? The distribution of ticks in Virginia is expanding and tick-borne diseases are on the rise. But what is the probability of contracting a tick-borne disease? How serious are these diseases to our health, and what can we do to protect ourselves outdoors? Dr. Holly Gaff, professor and chair of biological sciences at Old Dominion University, answers your questions about the complexities of these parasites and their implications on human health. Dr. Gaff tackles myths and truths about tick behavior, the expansion of ticks, and the importance of environmental balance. Discover practical advice on how to keep these bloodsuckers at bay while respecting their place in our ecosystem. Let's go! Virginia Outdoor Adventures is sponsored by Brakes Interstate Park. Breathtaking views, towering cliffs, roaring rivers, unlimited adventure. Discover the rugged beauty of Brakes Park, home of the Grand Canyon of the South. From rock climbing to mountain biking, elk tours to canyon rim ziplining, your adventure awaits at the Brakes. Don't miss your chance to experience Appalachia's greatest conservation story. Elk have returned to Southwest Virginia, and you can experience them in their natural habitat. Reservations for this spring's elk viewing bus tour from Brakes Park are available now. Book your elk tour today. Click on Brakes Interstate Park in your show notes to visit brakespark.com. Dr. Gaff, welcome to Virginia Outdoor Adventures.
Thanks for having me.
Why have you chosen to study ticks and tick-borne diseases in Virginia?
So my study of ticks and tick-borne diseases actually started when I was in graduate school in Tennessee and was working in studying mathematics, and I was interested in biology and in medicine and a few other things, and happened to be an outbreak of ehrlichiosis in Cumberland County, Tennessee in the 90s when I was there in grad school. And my PhD advisor kind of lured me into working on this project because he quickly realized, after doing some research and background before he handed it to me, that there was very little work done in understanding risk modeling of ticks and tick-borne diseases around the world, let alone in Tennessee or the southeastern United States. And so he sent me down this adventure of trying to create mathematical models to understand when and where we could find ticks, when and where we'd run into tick-borne diseases, why they were at that time. That was really kind of the beginning of this expansion of tick-borne diseases, why it was on the rise, why ticks were moving. So many questions that are very difficult to answer in reality. And so here I go as a little mathematician trying to answer all these questions. And I worked on that for a long time and did a couple other jobs and in and out, and finally ended up here at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. At Old Dominion at that time was one of the internationally recognized tick experts, Dan Son and Chine. And I had been struggling with building my mathematical models for a long time because there wasn't really good data out there to support the models. And so I got here and I'm like, all right, Dan Son and Chine knows everyone about everything and everything tick related. And, you know, he's an international tick god. And so I asked him if he could give me some data to actually build a better model. And he will admit today that he lied to me, but he tricked me into going outside. So instead of having the data for me, he said, well, nobody's ever collected data thinking about modeling. And so that part was actually true. It's often we collect data like we do in any kind of disease where we don't really collect it unless somebody's sick. But then how do you know these data are different than what it was before if you don't have a before? And so He didn't lie about that part. That part was true. What he did say that tricked me was, it'll be really easy. Just go outside for a couple years and then you can come back inside and do your math. Well, that was in 2009. And here we are in 2024. And he knew I would get too interested in all the changes and the dynamics. And there's so much going on, particularly here in Virginia, where we have exposures coming down from the north and we have other things coming up from the south. And so we're in this really interesting mixing zone. And we started before some of these things moved through, so we've tracked them moving through. I do think I know less now than when I started, because it's just such a complicated and interesting system. And so I've become committed to really long-term surveillance and long-term study of these changes in Virginia to better inform the public about risks of ticks and tick-borne diseases. And I'm happy to say I finally have enough data kind of getting back to some modeling, but it's far more questions than I ever thought out there.
Well, I, for one, am incredibly grateful to you and your team for doing this research. If there is such a thing as an international tick god, I'm glad he exists here in Virginia. And yeah. I'll bet you have some really interesting party stories as a result of your work.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My social life wasn't great studying math, so I started studying ticks as well. And so I don't know if that really helps anything.
Yeah, I'll bet. Okay, so for this episode, I solicited listener questions because I often get questions about ticks and I often see people posting different comments and questions about ticks. So this topic was something that was highly requested by my listeners. I'm really grateful for you to come onto the show and give us your time, but also I wanted to give people an opportunity to ask their questions. So I put it out there and I got, oh my gosh, so many questions. And what I did was many of them were kind of basic questions or repetitive questions. So I took those ones and I folded them into an introduction that we're going to do first. And then I saved sort of the more unique questions for the end. So we'll do an overview. And then at the end, I'll go ahead and ask you those listener questions that I received that I thought were a little different from just the basic information. So how does that sound for you?
Oh, that sounds great. Okay. So to answer people's questions. So
yeah, right. Okay. So the first question is it's a little bit loaded, I'm going to admit, but the question is, should people be afraid of ticks?
So ticks kind of have that gross factor that kind of complicates the situation, right? So I always advocate for people to understand risks, right? So again, as I mentioned, I come kind of from this risk thinking mentality. And so I think we need to keep them in context of where they are. I mean, ticks and tick-borne diseases are a real threat. There's no denying that. I kind of put them in the same category as driving. And I drive every day, right? I should have a healthy fear of driving on most of the roads in Virginia, I think. But there are a lot of things I can do to make myself safer when I drive. I wear my seatbelt. I, you know, follow the speed limit. I have airbags in my car. We've done a lot of different things to make ourselves safer while driving to mitigate some of those risks. And I think of ticks in that same kind of category. You need to have a healthy respect for them. There is a lot of public information out there. People usually know what they should do, right? They should, you know, tuck their pants into their socks. They should check when they come back. Most people are aware of the messaging of ticks. It's just a matter of making yourself do it in the same way that I know the laws used to be that people wouldn't wear their seatbelts, right? I mean, we do that now. And so it's just coming to create the habits of a healthy respect. They're amazing little creatures. And so I don't know that you should be afraid of them, because then that gives them maybe more power than they deserve. But I think a healthy respect is a better way to think about them.
That makes sense. And then how many species of ticks can be found in Virginia? And do they all bite humans? Do they all carry diseases?
The answer is really we have about 20 species of ticks here in Virginia. There are about 6 or 7 that will bite humans. The rest are animal specific. And so there's one that only feeds on birds, and there's one that likes to feed on groundhogs. And there's some that are very tied to their animals. And then I think it is important to understand that in many ways, each species of tick is associated with certain pathogens. And so it's like the concept of microbiome. We're much more aware of our own suite of microbes that live in our, you know, stomach, midgut, body, wherever you want to talk about, that we're thinking more and more about how those complex populations of microbes that make such an important benefit for us, right? And so ticks also have a little microbiome suite, and often it will include a pathogen or two towards humans, but that's not generally the intent. There's actually some of these human pathogens that are actually thought to be beneficial for the ticks, and so it could just be part of their actual microbiome that does them good. It's just we get in their way and they make us sick.
So are there certain species that we should be more concerned about than others?
So I think, in Virginia, 90% of the ticks that you'll encounter, at least in the eastern two-thirds of Virginia, is going to be the Lone Star tick, of probably the species of most concern. Throughout the state, we do have the black-legged tick that can transmit the pathogen that causes Lyme disease, especially up when you get up into the mountains, and that will become more prominent than it is down here in Hampton Roads area, for example. To me, yeah, Lyme disease is a major concern. It's the number one tick-borne disease in the U.S. and even here in Virginia. And so black-legged ticks are something to be very aware of and concerned with. But the Lone Star tick is really starting to also get people's awareness from the alpha-gal allergy. So this red meat allergy that is associated with exposure to the saliva of a Lone Star tick. So when ticks bite you, as gross as this sounds, their saliva will get into you. And so that will trigger an allergy for some folks, which has some delayed anaphylaxis. And so those are the big two that I would say here in Virginia.
How many tick-borne diseases are present? You mentioned Lyme's and alpha-gal, but are there others? And are Lyme's and alpha-gal the most common? And of those, like, which are the most concerning as far as, you know, how severe the disease can be?
Sure. So I think Lyme is certainly the most common. Lyme disease is incredibly underreported, right? And I think there's a number of diseases that are reportable by the state of Virginia to the CDC, and Lyme is one of those. One caveat for all case counts of all tick-borne diseases is they tend to present with very nondescript symptoms and often are misdiagnosed. So the CDC's latest estimates are that there's probably 10 to 100-fold more cases than are actually reported. And so it's probably on the order of, you know, the CDC has reports of probably 5 to 10,000 cases in Virginia, but it's probably 10 to 100 times more than that, just because A, it can be misdiagnosed, or B, you can have a doctor that treats you with doxycycline, which is almost the treatment for all tick-borne diseases, and just not report the paperwork because paperwork's a pain. But alpha-gal is actually really up and coming. I mean, as far as numbers-wise, it seems to be more and more prevalent. I've run into more and more folks that have it. The most serious ones from a health life perspective, I mean, both of those can be very life-altering. They don't tend to have as much case fatality as something like ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, spotted fever group rickettsiosis, or the viral diseases like powassan or Bourbon virus. We have all of those. Those are really rare in our state at this time compared to the others that we've talked about, but can be very, very much higher chance of being very ill.
I could see where it would be difficult to diagnose some of these cases, especially if people aren't reporting. I know I shared with you earlier that I contracted alpha-gal in 2008, and at that time, the doctors didn't even know it existed. So I had been to several doctors, and they all ran multiple tests, and all the tests came back normal, and no doctor could tell me what was going on. And it wasn't until 2018, an entire decade later, that it just so happened, a friend of mine who's a nurse practitioner said, "Hey, do you know about this disease called alpha-gal, and it's, you know, carried by ticks?" And all of a sudden the light bulb went off, and I went, "What?" Yeah. So I could see where, you know, probably the numbers are much higher than what's actually being reported.
Yeah. And we still work with a lot of healthcare professionals to even train the fact that these diseases have changed dramatically in the Commonwealth in the last 15, 20 years. Even while I've been out collecting ticks and monitoring what we were doing with our long-term surveillance, there's a dramatic rise in the number of Lyme disease cases in Virginia for a variety of reasons, but it's swept through from Northern Virginia down through Roanoke, Richmond, Roanoke, that direction, and on into North Carolina. And so they're moving and getting physicians to understand that things are different than when they were in medical school is sometimes a challenge. And it's just very difficult. It's very difficult to test for these things. And so it's really difficult to diagnose them accurately for even under the best case scenario. So
yeah,
trying hard is hard. But yeah, like you said, alpha-gal's new, right? I mean, that's really new.
It's new in that people know what it is. Correct. Now, but it's not new because I've had it for 15 years now. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah, so it just takes a while to figure it out.
And then to get the information out, right? You would think that we like to think our medical community is always on top of all of the things, but we only have so many hours in a day, even with the best And so I think more that we can have informed patients as well that can help inform as they go.
Do you happen to know the numbers of how many cases of tick-borne diseases are reported in Virginia every year?
So alpha-gal just became reportable 2 weeks ago, so there's no real standard statistics for that.
And 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, the state finally passed the law 2 weeks ago that we are now going to have alpha-gal as a reportable disease in Virginia.
Wow.
Which is exciting, I think.
Exciting in a weird way.
Yeah. Lyme disease is in the tens of thousands of cases reported. Again, this is a reported case question, right? It's unclear exactly how many are not reported.
Virginia's Mountain Playground awaits you in Giles, home of Cascade Falls. Hiking opportunities abound in Giles with over 50 miles of the Appalachian Trail that passes through the county seat of Parrisburg and the town of Narrows, which are official Appalachian Trail communities. For those who want to venture off the beaten path, Dismal Falls is one of my favorite hikes to a 40-foot-wide series of small but beautiful falls into a single whirlpool. The best accommodations in the New River Valley are in Giles, with Mountain Lake Lodge, Lily Valley Inn Bed and Breakfast, a variety of quality rustic cabins and historic inns. Visitors have a wide range of comfort to choose from. Mountain Lake Lodge, a historic property and backdrop for the film Dirty Dancing, is situated on a 2,600-acre woodland preserve with hiking trails to scenic vistas. Soon to be the home of the brand new Giles County Trail Center, the facility will connect visitors and residents to natural and cultural assets throughout the New River region. The Trail Center and new 4-mile loop trail to Bald Knob will make the highest point in the New River Valley readily accessible to hikers of all skill levels, as well as access to more than 20 miles of other trails on Mountain Lake property. Giles is proud to partner with the Eastern Divide Ranger District to welcome you to Cascade Falls. I would agree that Cascade Falls is one of the most beautiful waterfalls in Virginia and possibly on the entire East Coast. 150,000 hikers visit Cascade every year. We thank you for doing your part to ensure we preserve this Virginia treasure for generations to come. Start planning your visit to Giles by clicking on Visit Giles in the show notes of your listening app. So, Holly, what are the odds of contracting a disease from a tick bite? Like, let's say you do get bit by a tick. What are the odds that you're going to catch something?
So that's a great question. So the of course, it depends on the tick species, right? So as I mentioned a bit ago, like there's an association between the black-legged tick and Lyme disease and the Lone Star tick, which can actually transmit like ehrlichiosis or some of the other viruses. And so assuming you have, for example, a black-legged tick, the ones we've tested in the state, it's about a 25% chance that you would have exposure to that pathogen. And then you have to have the right conditions for your body to not be able to fight it off immediately. So it's not negligible, obviously, if you've been bitten by a tick, but it's not a guarantee either. And with ehrlichiosis, it's less than 1% of the Lone Stars that we've tested that would have that particular pathogen in them. Also kind of depends on the life stage, right? So ticks have 3 major life stages, are eggs first, but then larvae, nymphs, and adults. And some tick-borne diseases are able to be transmitted to the eggs. And so the larvae are born infected. So like pathogens that can cause what would probably be called Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but includes a whole bunch of other related diseases. So the CDC now calls it spotted fever group rickettsiosis. It's a whole mouthful, right? But that can be even acquired from a larva, but most pathogens are going to be much higher rate when they're nymphs. And then it's higher when they're adults, but adults are also bigger. And so you tend to catch them sooner. Or see them more likely than you would the nymphs, which are tiny, and the larvae, which are microscopic, basically, for most people. It's like, we think of them as specks of dirt with legs when we're collecting them in the field.
A couple of years ago, a friend of mine had posted some pictures on Facebook. She had gone out hiking and didn't check herself when she got back. And she had walked through like a nest of all these tiny ticks. And she went to bed not knowing that they were on her. And in the morning, she had a rash all over her body. And I looked at the pictures and was like, what? I didn't even know this was a thing. But thank goodness that she shared it, because not even 3 days later, I went for a hike and I was walking on a trail that was overgrown. I had crew length socks on with long pants, and this was like September, but I always wear long pants when I'm hiking, pretty much, no matter what. And when I got home and I was getting in the shower, I saw what I thought was dirt at the top of the sock line, and I tried brushing it off and it wouldn't come off. And I was thinking, what the heck is going on that this dirt isn't coming off? And then all of a sudden it clicked, thinking back to what my friend had posted just a few days before. And so I looked closer and sure enough, they were moving. And I was like, oh my gosh. And so luckily I knew what I was looking at and was able to get them off. But otherwise I would have just presumed it was dirt and, you know, proceeded with the shower and not even probably paid any more attention to it. But that was really an eye opener for me.
Yeah, the Lone Star, the most common one, it's for larvae to attack, and they attack in, like you said, large numbers, little larval bombs, larval mass. They all come up at the same time. They stay together. And then, yeah, you get 500 new little best friends crawling up your leg. So it's a rite of passage in my lab to at least have been larval bombed a couple times.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. And you were telling me when we were together out in the field that keeping a lint brush handy with you is a good idea.
Yeah, it's the easiest. Tape of any kind is the easiest way to get them off. You get a little lint roller, lint brush of any kind, and get them on some tape and fold that tape in sticky side to sticky side. And that is the quickest way to get them picked up, because otherwise you'll be there for a long time. They will not brush off, like you said. They're determined.
A lint roller. That's what I meant to say. Not lint brush. So yeah, I have added one of those little travel lint rollers to my pack now.
Two little ones. Yeah, they're easy. Throw them in your pack, man. It's easy. And then put them in your car at least.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you told me that, because that has now gone in next to my first aid kit, which has tweezers in it for that very reason too.
Brilliant. Yes, absolutely. All good things.
So what's contributing to the increase of ticks in Virginia? I hear people saying climate change all the time. Is that it, or is there other factors?
So it's complicated, right? Like everything in science, I think there's really two factors. So certainly climate change has changed things, right? The climate is different than it was. It's warmer. It's certainly moister. The one surefired way to kill a tick, right? Ticks are almost impossible to kill, is through desiccation. So the more humidity we get, the less likely they are to die. But climate change isn't the whole story. So Virginia, one of the big changes we have in the entire East Coast of the United States, actually is a bit of a history lesson, in that back around the time of World War I, so the early 1900s to the 1920s, white-tailed deer were eaten to near extinction. And so we have all these hunt laws about how many deer you can take and all of the hunting regulations that go along with that were to protect this species that we had nearly decimated, which is weird to think about today, considering how many, insurance claims there are for cars that hit deer and how much they are a pest in so many places. We had become such an agrarian society, and we had deforested the entire eastern part of the United States. And then the Industrial Revolution happened. And as part of the change in economy, we reforested the eastern part of the United States. And so we have a lot of forests now that are about 100 years old. And so as the trees came back, the deer came back. As the deer came back, the ticks came with them. And then the pathogens, of course, come along for the ride as well. And I think about it a lot of times from an ecology perspective, that what we did not bring back when we brought all of those back was also those top predators, because we don't like those. They scare us. And so we end up with this ecology of weedy species like deer that do replication really well, and raccoons and rodents and all these things that also make excellent tick food. And they're often out of control. We have an overabundance of a lot of these different species of hosts that then just create a lot more ticks. And so some of it is, we have built a better tick world for them, not for us. We also live, you know, we like to live out. People like to see a deer. They think Bambi is cute, and they like bunnies, and they like, you know, even raccoons sometimes. And so we've just kind of moved into this world where we create an imbalanced ecology. And ticks are kind of that tail that we end up with, because they're out of whack. They're out of balance. And it's a overwhelming amount of tick food, I guess, in our area. But then climate change, right? So then it's warm enough and wet enough to also allow all of them to survive. And so it creates a very dangerous situation, far more than it was even probably 50 years ago.
So when you say a lack of predators, are you talking about coyotes?
Yeah, coyotes would be, you know, very useful. Bobcats, right? I mean, we don't like things that would also eat our cats and dogs. And so there's still a pelt reward here in Virginia, last I knew, to kill coyotes.
I could see that, because I know in my neighborhood in Fairfax County, if anybody sees a coyote, they post it on Nextdoor and everybody starts freaking out. Like, grab your dogs, put everything inside, hide for your lives. There's a coyote outside. And you know. But it sounds like what we're saying here is that we actually need those predators to keep the balance in check.
Correct. And so, yeah, again, it's one of those can't pick and choose without getting some consequences.
Right. Are there any common misconceptions about ticks? I've heard all kinds of strange things, and I'll bet you have too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the most common is that the conception that ticks fall from trees, right? I argue with people all the time. So ticks live on the ground. Ticks live down in that leaf litter. There are some that will be in grass fields. There are some that will be in forests. There are some that will be in both. But no tick in the United States, in this part of the United States particularly, live in the trees. They don't fall from the tree. They're not going to, they got on your head, yes, but they got there by crawling up your body. And that's just, that usually freaks most people out to talk about. But it changes how you think about tick safety, because why we say tuck your pants into your socks and wear long pants, like you do a great job of, it sounds like, is because they're coming up from the ground. They're going to crawl up you. They might jump on at your pant legs and crawl up. But people will argue that I'm wearing a hat, I won't get any ticks. And that's not quite true.
Yeah. Well, until I met you, I was under the impression that if you just stay on a trail and you avoid tall grass, that you'll be fine. But after meeting you and learning that they live in the leaf litter, now it sounds like you could just be walking on a trail and pick them up.
Absolutely. And especially if you stop or you hesitate, or Lone Stars are known to, you know, they'll go 10, 20 meters to their pursuit ticks. And so they'll actually chase you down. And if you sit on the ground, they'll come at you. They're attracted to carbon dioxide and they're attracted to movement. And so we're good at both of those. And so they'll definitely, Lone Stars will move at you. Other ticks don't move as much, but those guys will definitely come at you.
So if I stop on the trail to take a rest or have a snack and I'm sitting on a log or a rock, even though my feet are still on the trail, that's sort of the prime opportunity for them to jump on. Is that right?
Absolutely. Because you got to think about, that's often where an animal would stop to forage. And so if you think about it, ticks are trying to get on where a white-tailed deer would gawk through or lay down, or where other animals will move. And so edges along paths are actually a really good place for most ticks to jump. They don't jump to crawl onto animals or grab on as they move by.
Okay, good to know. I think we're going to move on to some listener submitted questions. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to group a couple of these together because some of them are sort of on the same topic, including the first two. So Todd asked, can tick nymphs and larvae bite, and can they spread disease? And then Maura asked, is it true that if a tick has bit you for less than 24 hours, that they won't give you a disease?
Great questions. Adults of 7 different species will bite you. Nymphs and larvae of only a few species will bite us. So like I said, the Lone Star, ubiquitous. They like large animals in all three blood meals. But like the dog tick, the American dog tick, which is actually one of the most common for people to find on their head, or if you've been, that's the one in the grass fields that a lot of people have come in contact with, least likely to make you sick. But the nymphs and larvae of that species actually will not feed on humans. They'll feed on rodents because they're down in the leaf litter looking for small mammals. And so generally the nymphs and larvae of black-legged ticks and lone star ticks will indeed bite you. And they can spread disease. And so, again, that's probably part of their natural microbiome, that they could give you something. If they've had a larval meal on something else, they're more likely to have picked up a pathogen from that animal and be able to transmit it. But even larvae are something to get off and pay attention to just as much. And the 24-hour question is a great one, too. This is something that science, we haven't finished figuring this question out. And so it depends on the disease we're talking about. So Lyme disease, again, is the first one to start with. Most people are familiar with. And that pathogen biologically will stay in the stomach or the midgut of a tick until its next blood meal. And then it's activated and then moves out through the hemolymph into the salivary gland, from the salivary gland back to the person. And so because there's that delay and when it leaves their stomach, it does take 24 to 48 hours for it to complete that entire process. However, if we're talking about Ehrlichiosis, Babesiosis, Anaplasmosis, Bidifubrictosis, all the other bacterial and protozoan type diseases, those are generally, we think, about 8 hours because they've already left the midgut at the previous blood meal. And if you really want to get scared, the one that scares me the most are viruses, and viruses transmit within 15 minutes of bite. Rare, very unlikely, but you barely can even feel them at that point and have a chance of get them off. So they have to really prevent the bite to have that. And the alpha gal, I think, is a fairly quick exposure as well, because you're already immediate. I mean, the saliva is immediate. So I haven't seen a timeline on that for anybody actually demonstrating it, but it definitely is. I would not count on a 24-hour finding to be a reprieve from worry. Something to pay attention to.
So it sounds like it all depends, but the moral of the story here is to check yourself as soon as you possibly can.
Correct.
Amy would like to know, what signs should someone look for after removing a tick?
So I think the biggest one we tell people to watch for if you're worried about a disease after exposure would be any kind of fever or rash in the next 2 to 3 days or week. It's usually fairly quickly after that you would want to watch for any kind of exposure. Now, you will sometimes get that infection or allergic reaction at a tick bite that can look like something to be concerned about, which is why I definitely go to your doctor. I am not going to be a physician here, but things to watch for certainly are rash and fever.
Would you hike 18 miles to some of Shenandoah National Park's most iconic locations to grant the wish of a critically ill child in Virginia? Since 1987, Make-A-Wish Greater Virginia has granted more than 5,800 wishes in our local Virginia communities, including 167 wishes granted last year. That's a lot, but with a pipeline of nearly 300 local kids with critical illnesses waiting for their wish to be granted, it's important to support this amazing organization. That's why I've registered to be a part of Make-A-Wish Greater Virginia's Trailblaze Challenge on April 13th, where I've committed to hiking 18 miles through Shenandoah National Park and raising $2,500 to support wishes being granted to children and their families. Together with Make-A-Wish Greater Virginia, I invite you to be a part of my journey filled with adventure, camaraderie, and devotion to wish kids and their families. Support a child in Virginia waiting for their wish to be granted by contributing to my fundraising page. Press pause on your podcast player and click on Contribute to my Make-A-Wish Trailblaze Challenge in the show notes of your listening app. Okay, the next two questions are kind of similar. Ren would like to know, are there any particular clothing materials ticks like or dislike? And Kelly asked, how can I repel ticks without using DEET?
Sure. So ticks are incredibly motivated to feed. And so this is one of the things we have to overcome is I mentioned that there are three life stages of ticks. What I didn't say was they actually are about a year apart. And so the tick will fully have a good, nice little blood meal, fall off, and stays in that leaf litter laying there for up to a year. And then it comes back up to feed again. And so it's really motivated to try to find something to feed on. So we have not found certain materials that ticks will like or dislike. They definitely cling more to corduroy or anything that's got texture to it than it would to something that's slicker. But that's still reducing by 50% isn't really going to get you a whole lot. And socks are great material. Ticks like socks and shoelaces. Those have good stickiness to them, if you will, from a small little barbs that ticks have on their feet. So repelling ticks, I mean, DEET is obviously useful, but I understand the lack of interest in using it. It's always terrifying when it's eaten to the plastic of your cell phone cover if you use it too often. So we do use, if you're willing to use a chemical at all, we use a chemical called permethrin, which is a pyrethroid, a derivative of chrysanthemums. And you can spray your shoes. So rather than spraying your, you do not put it on your body, follow the label instructions. I will say that for sure. But you can use it to treat your shoes, which has far less likely to come in contact with your body. It is a neurotoxin. It will kill a tick within about 15 to 45 minutes after contact. So if a tick walks across your shoes to try and get to you, it will die before it can embed. So we treat our boots in our lab when we're going out tick collecting. That's pretty well. I also treat my car mats. This is one of the things that has saved me a lot while driving down the road, so you don't have a tick walking across your windshield. Or you can also treat like your tent. There are some other chemicals and treatments that are coming on the market, I think, in the next probably 5 to 10 years that... there's one called Nucotone that's a grapefruit derivative. And there's been some folks that have shown that at least there's some deterrence of cedar oils and lemon oils and a couple of the other more natural. But again, you're going to reduce your chance. You just can't assume that they are going to save you and still be committed to those tick checks when you get back.
That's exciting to hear because I've been using a lot of the natural products because the idea of spraying these really nasty chemicals, even just on my clothes, because you touch your clothes and your clothes go in the washing machine and it's going to spread to your other clothes. And I don't like that. But I also was never really sure if the natural products worked. So I hope that they do come up with something better. But I assume Kelly is asking about DEET because she doesn't want to be exposed to the chemicals. And it sounds like this permethrin is also maybe not as great.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those. It's where your line is for use of chemicals versus chance of illness, right? The other advocate I always tell people is when you come back, to put everything through a dryer. Your household don't wash them first. If you're throw them through a dryer for 10 to 15 minutes, and pretty much every tick that's in, you can't even see the tiny ones. Everything will be dead.
Why couldn't you just throw it in the washing machine and then the dryer like you normally would?
So the washer actually will add enough moisture that then you'd have to dry it for a little, at least our data show you have to dry it for a little bit over an hour, which is a really long time to dry something, to get it dry enough to actually kill the ticks.
Oh, so if you put it in your washing machine, it's like feeding the tick.
Correct. Yeah, you're resuscitating it back to a happy little moist area. And of course, people are like, well, doesn't the tick drown, right? Especially if you have a top loader, older school. But we did a cool study here. A student asked about, well, she was asking about hurricanes, whether hurricanes were helpful for drowning ticks. And so we put ticks underwater and ticks stayed underwater and were still alive. The last one died at 74 days underwater.
Oh my gosh. They can live for 74 days underwater without air?
Correct.
Oh, that's a little scary.
Yeah, they're amazing. They're truly amazing. So,
yeah, I mean, they are because... It seems like it's so difficult to kill them too. Like even when I remove them, if you've ever tried to squish one, it's pretty much impossible. It doesn't matter what you do to it. It just stands up and starts crawling again, no matter how you try to squish it. And then you hear these stories that if you try to flush it or wash it down your drain, that they'll just crawl back up. Is that true?
I mean, they certainly can. They can survive in the water. The wastewater treatment facilities, I mean, it gets far enough down, they're not going to crawl back out. But yeah, they'll crawl right back out of a moat of water with no problem.
It's amazing to me. It really is. Okay, so the next question is from James. Now, James lives in North Carolina, but he does a lot of backpacking in Virginia. And he would like to know about how far north does Lyme disease become more prevalent in ticks?
So there's been a big shift in Lyme disease. Lyme disease was originally obviously from Lyme, Connecticut. That's where the name came from, and has swept from there southwards. So there is what we're classifying at this point, a subset of black-legged ticks moving down from the north that are far more aggressive. And our southern black-legged ticks are much more lazy or polite or whatever term you want to give them. And so it's not so much there's a difference in the pathogen Borrelia burgdorferi. There's a little bit because of southern black-legged ticks tend to feed on lizards, which they don't have up north, and lizards are not as good at amplifying so they don't get Lyme disease at all. And so small mammals, white-footed mice, are more prevalent up north. And so the host they use determines the pathogens they have. And so it's been shifting, right? All these things are moving around, and climate change, now lizards are moving further north. But at the same time, this more aggressive black-legged tick is moving south. And so we're kind of in this crossroads of bad news as far as Lyme disease. That swept, so 2007, it started here in Virginia and swept all the way down through North Carolina. And the data I saw from last year was it was starting to hit the edge of South Carolina, in that kind of like draw line from Northern Virginia to the Trino, the Chapel Hill area, and just keep going southward along. It's just on the edge of the mountains is where it's kind of heading south. We're not sure where it's going, and didn't quite wrap around back here to Hampton Roads yet. We keep waiting for it. And so it's complicated. And as far as if you go further north, right, it's expanding into Canada, but that's pretty much a climate change move up there. And so we have a whole bunch of complicating things moving Lyme disease around in our area.
Kevin says that he had very bad Lyme disease 12 years ago and was treated and felt back to normal. But he'd like to know, is it possible that it could come back? And if it does, could it be worse?
So this is actually a good case study where we may have learned something good from COVID. So one of the big challenges with Lyme disease for a long time was the challenge of understanding the chronic sequelae, or this long Lyme or chronic Lyme. There's a lot of terms for it, where someone can have Lyme disease, they can clear it, at least the acute infection of it, but then their body can still be a problem. They can have all kinds of different signs and symptoms and issues. Hopefully with most people, when they're back to normal, they don't usually come back to long Lyme, but we don't fully understand it in the same way that chronic COVID and long COVID has really become a concept that we're all comfortable with and has actually done a lot of good, in my opinion, for helping understand the science behind long-term Lyme disease for a lot of folks. For example, one of the big questions that's still out there is there's these studies that show that Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative agent, could go into some kind of biofilm, and it might be able to hide out for a long time and then reactivate. But the studies are not conclusive at all on that. So there's a lot of research that needs to be done. And thankfully, there's a lot of folks starting to work on that and getting more momentum towards that to hopefully treat people who do have long Lyme and get us a better idea of understanding how to treat acute Lyme so that we don't trigger that.
Okay, the next question is from Ellie, who's a nurse and also happens to be an ODU grad. So she asks, why does it seem so hard to confirm and test for Lyme's and then harder to get Lyme's treatment?
Yeah, so Lyme disease, again, Borrelia burgdorferi is a weird bacteria. And unlike a lot of diseases, we go to the doctor and they're going to test you one of two ways. They like swab your nose or your throat, right, for COVID. That's what we do. Or they take blood and do a blood test. And generally that works. But Lyme disease bacteria will live inside the lining of your blood vessels, so the endothelial cells they're called, which is a really difficult place to test without taking like a chunk of you. And that might not be the right chunk, right? It could be in the veins and arteries somewhere in your body, but not throughout your entire body. And so we don't really know where it's going to go. Everybody's going to be different, makes it very difficult to identify where it is. And so what we end up looking for is an antibody test. And antibody tests are notoriously not as sensitive and specific as we would want them to be. And so because we can't test for the bacteria itself, we kind of have to look for the echo in your bloodstream of white blood cells that say that you have had it or you might have had it. And even those are not as likely as they would be. And so it gets really difficult to identify and find. And so when we test a tick, we take the whole tick and throw it in a jar and grind it all up. And I can tell you that there's really burgdorferi, but not a very good approach to humans to take you and grind you up. So that does not work well. and the treatment, the same thing, right? So treatment, we tend to either ingest it when it goes into our bloodstream. And so It for a bacteria that's not as accessible, it can be really difficult to get the treatment to it. So it's notorious for hiding out. It's trying to evade the immune system. It's also very patient. It's the best for, anthropomorphism, but it's still, it's a, it's a really, really difficult pathogen to identify and work with.
So I received several questions about alpha-gal, and this surprised me a little bit because to me, this means that there's a higher awareness of alpha-gal, especially more now than there was, say, when I contracted it 15 years ago. But still, Kathy would like to know, how can we spread the word about alpha-gal and how serious it is for some?
Yeah, I think that's the more we can talk about it, that we get it out, like we are talking about it now, we get it out to every community we can get it out to. If people talk about it with their doctors, they can, I mean, it is very serious for some folks, and finding allergists that know about it and can help educate other folks about it, that just have to keep advocating. I think the fact that it's reportable in Virginia now is a really big step that should help as well.
I've noticed that the word is getting out, because it used to be that when I told people I was allergic to meat, they didn't believe me.
Yeah.
They acted like I was making this up. It was some sort of crazy story. And now, let's say I'm going to an event and they want to know, do you have any allergies for the meal? And I write meat allergy. I've actually had people say, oh, do you have alpha-gal? So clearly it's getting out there. People seem to know what it is more now than before. And Kevin would like to know, is it possible for alpha-gal symptoms to ever go away or for symptoms to lessen?
So I think that is absolutely true. And so from the medical side and from the testing side, there's some really good researchers at both the University of North Carolina and University of Virginia that are working on this that would know far more than I do. But the presentation they gave a couple weeks ago in a CDC meeting I was in was looking at most folks, it wanes. Now, re-exposure will re-amplify this for a lot of people. So if you get bitten again, you could be right back where you started. And I know you've said you have had some changes in your alpha-gal over the time as well.
The research that I've seen says that over time, it usually goes away. And my experience has been, like today, 15 years later, if I wanted to eat a cheeseburger, I could do that without having the same allergic physical reaction that I've had in the past. But after so many years of getting sick just by the smell of meat, I don't have any interest anymore. You know, like, why would I want to touch something that made me sick every time I smelled it, let alone eat it? Your body gets trained to not want to anymore. I grew up in the Midwest in an immigrant household where we ate like fatty sausages and liver and like everything had meat. So when the doctor said to me, there's no biological or nutritional reason why you need to eat meat, so if it makes you sick, just don't eat it. I looked at him like, what? Like, what are you talking about? How am I going to survive? But over time I've learned to, and I know I shared with you that for me personally, in the long term, this is the best thing that ever could have happened to me, because it changed my eating habits for my lifetime in a good way. But I also understand that other people have had different experiences that is worse than what I've gone through. And for me, it was many, many years of not being able to go to a friend's house if they were, you know, serving a roast. Like if there was a roast in the oven and the whole house smelled like meat, I couldn't go. Or definitely couldn't go anywhere near a steakhouse. Or even just going home on a holiday and having those same fatty meats on the table in front of me where I could smell it. Like I couldn't tolerate it. But though over time, I've gotten better, but I still don't like it. Like I still don't want to be around it. Yeah. And I definitely could never go into a steakhouse and walk out with my hair and my clothes and my coat and everything smelling like it, because I just can't. Yeah. And my friends who hunt are absolutely terrified of getting alpha-gal. You know, that's like their yeah. worst possible nightmare. So I think it affects everybody differently, but that was my experience with it.
Yeah. It really has changed the game. I jokingly say I've been out here, you know, preaching tick and tick-borne disease risks for a long time, that it can really affect you and could even kill you. And that doesn't seem to impact people's lives near as much as telling them that they might not be able to eat that hamburger that they want to eat. That definitely gets a lot of people's attention. So.
Isn't it crazy?
It is crazy. It is crazy. But it is. Yeah. Yeah.
The official Virginia Outdoor Adventures merch store is back. Give your loved one or yourself the love of the outdoors while supporting the podcast with the super popular Love design featuring Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains. Every item in the merch store was thoughtfully selected to create quality products using eco-friendly materials. Get ready for your next adventure with long sleeve and slim fit tees, hoodies, beanies, and insulated water bottles and mugs. Your purchase will support the podcast, enabling me to produce more adventure-packed episodes. Shop now by clicking on Virginia Outdoor Adventures merch store in the show notes of your listening app. Okay, moving on. So I included this question from Maria because it has to do with her dog. And I know that a lot of people have pets and might be concerned about how this could affect their pets. So Maria says, my dog was diagnosed with anaplasmosis. She did 30 days of doxycycline. Is that right?
Yep.
And she's wondering if it will all, if the dog will always test positive for it.
So the standard veterinarians usually use something like a IDEX snap test. There's a couple other tests out there. And again, they're antibody tests. And so what it does mean is that the dog has had anaplasmosis at some point. And the length of time that they remain positive is certainly weeks to years later that they'll still test positive. Kind of depends on the dog. But a lot of times, yeah, it'll still test positive for a long time from it.
Okay, next question is from Glenn and Susanna, and they asked, what can we do aside from pesticides to keep the tick population down in our yard? For example, are there plants that we should or should not have around, and will removing leaves help?
Yeah, so this is one of those, again, balance that we try to find in life is the best way to keep ticks out is to, you know, mow your yard, rake your leaves, keep everything trimmed back, which is probably not great for a lot of other arthropods. And so we know, like, leave, you know, it's all about leaving the leaves for the all the pollinators that like to live under them, but ticks do well under there too. And so it is a challenge. I think the best bet is to try to find a compromise of a smaller area that you're willing to keep safer, keep it trimmed back, or keep it, you know, dryscaped, some level of something that will reduce the ground level humidity. That's your goal. Is leaf litter increases that ground level humidity, and as we've said now, ticks are good as long as they're moist, but a manicured, like a mowed yard, will keep the ground level humidity fairly dry, and so ticks don't survive very well into that. You also, CDC and then EPA have often recommended, like, then putting a mulch barrier between that safe zone, quote unquote, and any kind of wooded or natural area that you have. Not so much because it'll keep ticks from coming into your yard, but it's kind of a good physical reminder that you are leaving that yard and going into the tick world. And so kind of like giving them their yard and your yard and kind of drawing a line between them. It's probably your best bet. There are some plants that will bring more ticks, but they tend to be, again, some of the invasives do a really good job. Pretty much anything that will attract deer will attract ticks because the ticks ride on the deer. So that's kind of a downside of anything that makes happy deer is not a good thing for tick populations.
Yeah, I thought this was such a great question because there's more awareness now about having manicured lawns and, you know, removing and bagging all of your leaves, how that's really not good for the environment. And there are many, many native species of insects that need those leaves to nest or need certain plants to lay their eggs on. And those are a food source for pollinators and birds and other native species. So when you're removing leaves and you have this manicured lawn, you're removing a natural habitat that's needed. And also oftentimes people are then putting fertilizers and pesticides and other things on those lawns. And then, of course, that does additional damage. But right. Yet, if you don't want ticks, it almost seems like that's the thing to avoid. So it's an interesting question and an interesting debate.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And it's very difficult to try to tease apart how to live in the most balanced world that you can live in, because it's just way out of whack. So it's hard to do.
Mm-hmm. And then there's one more question, and this is actually my question. I saved it for last. We seem to vilify ticks a lot, but it seems to me that there must be some sort of purpose or benefit that ticks play in the ecosystem. So what's the good side of ticks?
Yeah, I mean, I jokingly refer to them as my neglected little microfauna because nobody likes them, but they They kind of play two roles as far as I see in the ecosystem that we understand today. And one is a little more morbid, but thinking about one of the best ways to keep a healthy population for any animal would be to remove the weak. And so ticks are really good at killing off weak animals, if you will. So the way that ticks feed, they give you your water back, but they'll anemiate an animal, so they don't truly exsanguinate them. They don't drink all their blood, but they'll take all the good parts of the blood and then give you the salt and water back, which is actually how they give you so many pathogens. But it definitely will. You'll see animals that are just often young, particularly if they are weak, will be just coated in ticks and then often pass away from that. And so it's a little, again, it's a little morbid side of the world, but nature is brutal on the weak because it strengthens the overall population. So the more positive way to think about them is probably if you have an image of an oxpecker sitting on the back of a buffalo in Africa, that it's going to eat ticks and other parasites, but ticks is one of the major ones off that buffalo. And so that bird is technically eating the buffalo one bite at a time, and there would be no way for that bird to actually take a bite of a buffalo. But the tick is a nice intermediary where it actually extracts the good proteins and other things out of that buffalo and provides it to the bird to eat. And so even when they're on the ground, ticks will often be a food source for birds or salamanders or other small animals that find these beautiful little protein bars basically sitting on the ground waiting to be consumed and can't run real fast because they're big and, well, gross looking from our perspective, but tasty looking from a lot of animals' perspective that will use that as a food source. And so I think of it as a way to eat a large animal one bite at a time.
Interesting. Yeah, this reminds me of when you and I were together at York River State Park. And well, first of all, you were showing me how you collect ticks, which I thought was really interesting. You had like, what was it, looked like a huge white surrender flag, but yeah. What was really just a big white cloth on a pole that you were dragging across the ground and then checking it to see if any, you know, ticks had hopped on. And this was January, I think, right? End of January, yep. Early February. And I was really relieved that we didn't find any. So that was good. But then also you said to me, yeah, I drove past a dead animal in the road a little ways back. And I was thinking about going back to pick it up and see what was on it. And I was like, ooh, can I come too? So we went back and you picked up the dead possum by its tail, which I was in my car taking a video of and thinking, oh, this is going to be really great on Instagram. But thinking about those food sources, how the ticks were or can feed on animals and then birds, you know, would then feed off the ticks that have fed off the animals. I think that's really interesting. And watching you pick through the fur of this dead possum on the back of your truck bed and trying to see what you can find based on, you know, what's available here in Virginia to collect that data was really interesting. And I was really glad that you invited me to see how you do that. That was cool.
Yeah, it is a crazy life that I sometimes question having left mathematics when you're doing such delightful things, especially if it's like midsummer and 110 degrees and you're standing in poison ivy and yeah, picking through smelly things. So it does question your life choices sometimes, but there's no better way to get the data that we need to understand these systems.
And yet it's so fascinating. Like I said, great party stories, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the first time I stop at something dead with a new student in the lab, they're slightly horrified, but you know, it'll weed out the week for even the grad students and undergrads as well. So.
Yeah, well, Holly, thank you so much for being a guest on Virginia Outdoor Adventures. How can listeners connect with you?
Yeah, we'd love to hear from folks, or if they have questions, we have Facebook, Instagram pages. If you just look for ODU Tick Team, that's our handle for those two. We have email. You certainly, if you just Google ODU Tick Team, ODU Ticks, it'll come to me. I am a professor here in biology. And so folks are more than happy to always shoot us emails, follow us on social media. We try to put up interesting things that the students are doing or presentations we're giving or where we're going to be to do things. We do a lot of outreach. You can come meet us. We have a tick costume and tick stickers and tick coloring pages. So we definitely try to get the information out to all levels, to all folks, but happy to try to direct people if they have other questions that we don't know to, we'll answer what we can.
Sounds good. I will put links to all of those in the show notes, especially the link to the ODU TIC team website, because that is a wealth of information.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fantastic.
Dr. Gaff, thank you so much for sharing your wealth of information with us about tick and tick-borne diseases.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Adventure on. Links and resources from this episode are in the show notes of your listening app and on the website at virginiaoutdooradventures.com. If you enjoyed the show, help spread the word by sharing your favorite episode with friends or on social media. Leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts also helps new listeners discover the show. Get news and information about outdoor adventures close to home by signing up for my newsletter. Click on Newsletter Sign Up in your show notes or visit virginiaoutdooradventures.com. I love hearing from my listeners. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook or email me at jessica@virginiaoutdooradventures.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, adventure on.